Arrow, said the bowman, Black Arrow, I have saved you to the last. You have never failed me, and always I have recovered you. I had you from my father, and he from of old. If ever you came from the forges of the true king under the mountain, go now, and speed well. Clifford, how you been?
Been pretty good. How are you, Patrick?
Nice. I'm pretty good. Yeah, I started, I was just telling you, I'm getting back into the classical musical jam.
Very cool. Any favorites lately?
New favorites? Not quite. I learned about some, how do you say his name? Djokovic?
Sure.
Dmitry, I don't know. He was like Soviet.
Okay.
Man, Russians are up there for epically long novels and composers.
Uh-huh.
Pretty sweet. Pretty sweet.
Yes.
I'm thankful for the Russian people for those two concepts.
Yeah. Robust cultural contribution.
Yeah. Indeed. It really is.
Yeah.
How have you been?
Solid. I passed my next exam for the architecture exam, so...
Is that a third one?
That's third one down. 3 for 3 right now.
Wow.
Got three more
nice
to go.
Nice job, buddy.
Thank you.
Nice. Nice.
So,
cool.
I've been on a perhaps a little bit reckless exam every 2 week schedule, so I'm trying to keep that going.
Do most people pass those like first try every 2 weeks?
I mean, most people take like a few months between each one. But
guys, Clifford's pretty smart. just...
So, well, basically, people tend to put them off until they're older. And then they, you know, it's a stressful thing. It's a lot of information. But I kind of figured if I'm in the mindset, I might as well just, you know, go as fast as I can. Try to knock them all out in a row. So I'm not wasting any time having to relearn stuff that I forgot from school or whatever. Yeah. Once again, might be a little bit reckless, but it's been going well so far, so I'm feeling good.
All right. Cool. All right, well, let's get into it then.
This is episode 14 of the Talk Tolkien podcast. We're going through chapter 14 of The Hobbit, Fire and Water.
All right, so a couple things happened here. We had a death of a major character.
Mm-hmm.
We'll talk about it. We'll talk about, was this death kind of anticlimactic? And we got another hero step, and then we'll talk about what the landscape kind of looks like for the rest of the book here. Or the start of the rest of the book.
Sounds like a pretty pivotal episode to me.
Indeed. Before that, though, before we get into it, though, Cliff's notes?
Yes.
All right.
So, at the start of the chapter, we rewind to the dwarves and Bilbo taking shelter in the entrance to the Lonely Mountain. If you remember, this is when they were, at the start of the last chapter, almost suffocating. Meanwhile, the men of Esgaroth, which is Lake Town, where they stopped after their barrel ride, are watching the sky and the horizon at night. Light by the Lonely Mountain leads some of them to proclaim that the king under the mountain has returned and is forging treasure once again. But Bard, a stern and pessimistic elder of the group, is convinced that it is the dragon Smaug flying towards them. He's soon proven right, and they sound the alarms, and the town prepares for battle. Its bridge is destroyed and sunk. The roofs are soaked with water, because after all, this town is made of wood and straw. But Smaug strikes anyways. He's bombarded with arrows from the town, all of which bounce off his scales. And that alone provokes him in a way that he hasn't been provoked in ages. No one has dared to battle against him since he took over the Lonely Mountain. He intends to destroy the town, to destroy every rescue boat one by one, to burn the fields and the forests and everything around. He's basically engaging in total war. And just as everyone's losing hope and diving into the water, Bard, whose fellow archers are also starting to bail, he strings his last arrow, and at that instant a thrush flies down from the mountain to speak in his ear. Bard is able to understand what the thrush says. We might get into this a little bit later, but he's a descendant of the town of Dale, and so he understands the thrush. He learns a weak spot in the dragon's armor, and when Smaug strikes again, Bard aims and hits the soft spot on Smaug's chest, and all of a sudden Smaug falls dead on top of the city. The townspeople, beaten, down, and stunned, are ultimately glad to have survived. Bard is praised as the new leader, much to the chagrin of the master of the town. Meanwhile, the birds of the land have begun to spread the word that Smaug is dead, and the king under the mountain has returned. Bjorn hears in his fortress, the elven king of the forest hears, the goblins of the misty mountains hear. The elven king, who is a friend of Ezgaroth and takes pity on them, leads his army with fresh supplies to feed and rebuild the city. The fighting men of the city and the elven host began moving towards the mountain with the treasure on their minds.
Right on!
So, what did you think of that, Patrick?
Well, no, what did you think of it?
Well, it's pretty exciting. I mean, on the one hand, this is what the whole book has kind of been pent up to at this point, right? This is the biggest challenge for them, is killing the dragon. And by them, I mean Bilbo and the dwarves, who didn't actually appear in this chapter at all.
Right, so I think we'll talk about that point a little bit later, but let's just start, this was the chapter we were all waiting for when the dragon was going to die, but it was very quick. I mean, it was probably about tied for shortest chapter of the book.
Yeah, it kind of surprised me. It was like we had impending doom, and then all of a sudden, Smaug's dead. Did that come off to you as being too fast? Is there any reason behind that?
Maybe it was too fast, but then again, it was like a pretty big battle scene, and this is a kid's book. Do we need to go into depth about like the gore and destruction that a dragon can create on a town, I guess?
No, I guess not. That makes sense. I suppose I was expecting more, maybe more strategy or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, overall, I probably did think it was too quick.
Mm-hmm.
But we'll talk about that in a little bit. Let's actually get into the death of Smaug himself.
So this battle to me, when Smaug attacks Ezgaroth, felt pretty one-sided to me until Bard receives this secret message from the Thrush.
And by one side, you mean like Smaug's dominating?
Easily. I mean, their arrows don't stand a chance against him. He's pretty much ready to destroy the town in spite of all their best defenses. They don't stand a chance, basically.
Well, when you can't really penetrate him with arrows, I mean, like, of course they don't stand a chance.
Yeah. It was just, the odds were crazy.
Well, so there's a couple of things going on here. So, the first thing I was reading in both of Tom Shippey's books about it, he made a point to point out that the men are very disciplined here, under Bard, you know? Bard's not fooled by, like, thinking the king's back under the mountain when they see, like, the light flame up around the mountain and everything.
Right.
You know, he's just like, the dragon's coming. You know, we gotta get ready. So he has the whole town ready, and, like, they prepare defenses.
Right,
like,
even though everyone called him a pessimist at first, he was right pretty quickly.
But, you know, he's filling up water buckets. They, you know, they get all their arrows ready. They destroy the bridge of the town. Somehow, like, that was a good defense? I don't really understand.
I get the impression, reading it, Smaug was very frustrated that they had destroyed the bridge, that they were surrounded by water. It was like that was, that somehow was kind of an impediment for him, or a barricade. Like, I thought it wouldn't be a problem because he's flying the whole time, but he seemed pretty put off by not having the bridge as the connection to the land.
My only thought of that was the bridge is really, really big, and he could stand on it, maybe, and so then he doesn't have the danger of falling into the water. I don't really know.
Okay.
That's the only thing I could think. I thought it was weird, too. But either way, it did sound like something you would do if you're preparing for battle. So whether it's like some sort of siege, which this is,
right,
or I don't know. You know, I mean, maybe it can sound like a medieval siege, but most of this is more modern. Like, the discipline of all the soldiers and everything. Like, they mention phrases like fight to the last arrow and hold your ground, and those, from what I was reading, weren't actually common until probably like the 1800s.
Really?
Yeah. And if you think about it, it's like, well, hold your ground. I don't know. In the medieval battles, it was sword fights where it's just like, you know, hand-to-hand combat as opposed to like holding some sort of line. You know, whether that's trenches or whether it's just, you know, you're in the musket line.
So you're saying that sort of like all or nothing mentality is a more modern warfare invention?
Well,
frankly, that surprises me if that's the case.
Fight to the last arrow is like you can insert round or, you know, any sort of ammunition.
Right. Modern ammunition. Yeah, of course.
And then hold your ground. I mean, it's just, you know, the medieval people, it's like, yeah, you defended your walls, you know, because you had walls back then.
Uh-huh.
Now you don't have walls because they're not very useful when there's big artillery.
Right.
But, and like, you know, you can imagine either like a trench line or like Napoleon or Revolutionary War times where, you know, you just stood in the line. Mm-hmm. Like you actually held the line and, you know, hold your ground or hold the line, you know, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Where they're just, you know, it's balls of steel walking up to each other and you're going to fire a musket at the other guy.
Right.
You know, just hope you don't get shot, you know, because the guns were so inaccurate.
Right, yeah. Right. So you're saying the kind of, I don't know how you'd put it, the open warfare concept might be the modern aspect.
Well, and then the other thing that goes with that too is, you know, you're working as a unit as opposed to a great individual that you always hear about in all these stories.
Okay.
You know? Like all the ancient stories, it's like, especially Beowulf, like, that guy was so cocky. He's just like, I went in there and, you know, I had some troops, but I let one of my troops get killed,
yeah, yeah.
And then I found the monster as he's getting killed, and I fought.
Right, right, right.
I mean, it's, like, super glorious about just, like, the individual. Same with the Odyssey. Like, every single one of Odysseus' crew members is dead that after that trip. He's the only one that makes it back.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense to me. Like, although Bard is singled out as a unique character here, on the whole, the men are fighting as a unit.
Well, that's kind of what we do come to, is we do end up, though, yeah, there's all this discipline stuff, and of course, you know, Tolkien, you know, obviously he was part of that,
mm-hmm.
in World War I, so he would have that on his mind,
mm-hmm.
and, you know.
How much do you see this as a direct reference to Tolkien's past, fighting in the war? Like, is smog aerial warfare? This is kind of a flyby, bombarding the trenches?
Well, in World War One, I don't know if the planes actually bombarded trenches. I don't think planes really had bombs. I feel like it was more just dogfighting.
Fair. Okay. You don't think they were strafing trenches at all?
If anything, I think they were sending blimps with bombs. I don't think the planes.
That's fair. That's fair. I guess I'm mixing it up with World War Two.
What they were doing with, they had the huge artillery though. That was like the first time that like stuff could fire for like miles,
right.
You know, as opposed to just like a cannon. You know,
right.
Like the cannonball is just, I don't know, that's what you imagine in movies. But the artillery stuff, it's just, yeah, that's miles
mm-hmm.
away. Holy crap.
And shooting mortars out of the trenches and that type of thing.
I mean, that was definitely on his mind when he wrote this, because discipline, I think that was, that has to go back to, like, the Revolutionary War, Napoleon time, when, like, seriously, like, yeah, everybody marched together as a unit and then lined up against the other people, and the guns were inaccurate enough that, like, your odds were, like, somewhat all right to survive,
mm-hmm.
you know, when you're just in a line and then you fire at each other. And mm-hmm. then you just hope, like, staying together, all the maneuvers that your commander's ordering works out, you know. And, like,
right.
somebody ends up flanking somebody and then they could shoot the other guys and then the cavalry can come in and finish off the job, you know.
Right, right.
And when the whole line breaks, you know, that's when you're definitely losing, right? When everybody starts to retreat as opposed
Certainly.
To... And it, you know, and they tried that in World War One. That's how World War One was starting. Like that's, and then all of a sudden, none of that was working. So like, they couldn't go any further. So they just dug a trench in, and you know, that's how they created the trenches. Was they tried to just march up to each other like they had been doing, but the
right.
guns were so good that they just started mowing each other down.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it's like, well, we gotta make some cover. So they made a trench.
Okay, so they did. Yeah, they had to build up their defenses and
mm-hmm.
basically play a more defensive game.
Tolkien would have seen all that. He would have enjoyed, or I don't know, the discipline was definitely in his mind. And so whether he was doing that on purpose, he brought that out in the story, maybe just to make this, give some action to the scene.
Uh-huh. Well, on that note of being, like, the trench warfare being more defensive, it certainly feels like this whole exchange, kind of what I was saying with the one-sidedness, it feels very desperate. It's the men who have discipline and who are taking action and being heroic, fighting to the last arrow. Ultimately, though, they're up against a tremendous force and are being kind of picked off or destroyed one by one. And so that kind of like desolate, hopeless like battle scenario might have harkened back to something for Tolkien, I would imagine.
Like something specific in battle?
I could just see it as a, even if it's not a specific instance, kind of like the hopelessness of whatever warfare he was engaged in.
We gotta save that for another time.
Okay.
Like I got stuff on that, but I don't know if that's coming up in this chat. Like, I don't know if he was ever completely hopeless, if that's what you're getting
at. Okay. Well, not necessarily hopeless, but like kind of this, like this is a much more brutal warfare than any fighting we've seen so far in the book, which I'd say has been a lot more clever and minuscule. And this is a like a warfare that's about destruction. And yeah, and this is the first time we have, like, at the end of the chapter, you have people whose homes and families have been destroyed by this battle.
Right, but this is also, besides the goblins, this is the first, like, real destructive force that we've come upon.
True, so, true.
And it's the dragon. He kind of lived up to his name. Mm-hmm. That's kind of what you expect from
him. Yes,
dragon.
That's fair. That's fair. We've alluded to him multiple times now. Who is this bard character? He seems to me like a bit of a dark horse. We've heard nothing about him before, and now he's the man of the chapter.
Right. Well, this is basically, we can only go off what we got in this chapter because we hadn't met him before. Mm-hmm. Like, even when the dwarves are in Lake Town, didn't meet him.
Right.
But let's see. It seems like bards, grim, brooding, seem tired to me kind of guy.
Right.
He can't be high ranking because he's on the Night's Watch, you know.
Like, right.
He's stuck with the crap job, you know.
Uh-huh.
Can't really tell if he's wise or not, but, you know, he's got his head about him that he's the only one that's actually prepared to alert the town about a dragon, mm-hmm. which is probably just about their whole job.
Certainly.
By that point, because it seemed like nothing else was going on with that town. It was pretty quiet and dull, usually.
Uh-huh. It struck me, like, a lot of the heroic or important characters we've met so far have, the way Tolkien describes them and the way they're presented, it's as though they have, like, an aura of power or goodness around them or something. Like, I can almost imagine them being backlit in every scene that they show up in. Like, whether it's Elrond or Bjorn or something like that, like, they're sort of...
Oh, I don't think I really imagine Bard being bad.
Well, no, this is what I'm getting to. Bard strikes me as a much more practical and kind of like compromised, grungy character than these other leaders that we've seen.
He seems washed up and,
yeah,
you know, like past his prime or something.
Yeah, but witty in a practical way, not a wise way, right?
Yeah. But, you know, once the battle starts, though, he's just fully in command because the master is a coward.
Right.
You know, the master who's supposed to be the leader of the town, complete coward.
Right.
And he's encouraging and rallying the troops wherever he goes and telling them, like, what to do. Like, he's the commander of the battle, mm-hmm. like, just straight up, period. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, that probably implies that he's older, so he's probably, and he's a soldier himself, so he's got the respect of the men who would have to defend the town, is what it seems.
And everyone listened to him as soon as he started giving orders, right?
Right, yeah. Well, it doesn't. We don't hear anything about them not, but actually, yeah, he does.
There was some mention that the explanation of why he could understand this thrush when it lands on his shoulder, which we assume to be the thrush that was watching Bilbo and the dwarves when they were getting in the back door of the mountain and overhearing Bilbo's conversation with the dwarves about Smaug.
Right.
The reason Bard can understand this thrush is because he's a direct descendant of the King of Dale.
Right.
Which, for everyone who's got their maps handy or who remembers a little geography descriptions from earlier in the story, Dale was sort of the once great city on this town, on the Long Lake, that thrived as the primary port when the dwarves ruled the Lonely Mountain. And when the Lonely Mountain was taken over by Smaug, Dale was destroyed, and Esgaroth is the kind of remnants of Dale that was built out on piers in the middle of the lake. So,
well, it's not the remnant. Like, that's like a different city. Because Dale was in the shadow of the mountain. Like, it was in between.
But Dale was flattened, effectively, right?
Yeah, it was totally destroyed.
Uh-huh.
I mean, well, there's still ruins, but yeah, I mean,
and Esgaroth is now the only city in that area.
Right. But it's still like 2 days away. 2 days away.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, I interpreted it as Esgaroth kind of picked up some of the slack as being the key port.
Well, but, clearly, because, I mean, Bard was a, well, he himself wasn't a refugee, but, you know, I think his dad or his grandpa was.
Right, so we get this connection to Dale, but what do we make of that? How big of a deal is that, that he has a connection to the King of Dale?
Well, yeah, so he said, because he's a man of Dale, they had the ability to understand the thrushes, so it's like, well, that's why he can understand it talking,
uh-huh.
But... yeah, I mean, you know, he's a kingly heir, which just, I think, adds to his prominence or credentials that he's a good candidate to kill the dragon. I mean,
well,
you know.
It sounds pretty, like, quite, like, magical, powerful to me to be able to understand thrushes. Like, he's got something special going on. Was Dale such a big deal that it was the kings kind of had this power?
I think it was just something in the area.
Okay.
You know?
Something like, in the water.
Well, Thorin had been saying that the thrushes could understand stuff in the chapter 12, so like 2 ago.
Okay.
Yeah. Which is like how, you know, the thrush listened to Bilbo, and that's when Thorin pointed it out. So it's like said, I don't know, that's like a plot point there. But I guess that's just a power of the land. Again, we can think it's magic, but to them, you know, is it like magician magic? No, it's probably just, you know, that's... some power.
Kind
or some,
of more like mysticism.
Yeah, just some like ancestral quality that's passed on to people.
Okay. Nevertheless, this thrush comes to Bard in the critical instant, right? And I guess we get an allusion to this in the chapter, but we guess that the thrush conveys everything that has happened at the mountain, specifically that Bilbo told the dwarves, I saw that Smaug has a soft spot on his belly, right?
Right. And so then Bard pulls out the black arrow, his last arrow.
Why is it the black arrow? Is it special?
I think it's literally black. And then they said it's like basically a family heirloom from they said it was forged in the mountain and was given to his grandpa or great grandpa or I don't know, some generations back, and somehow they still have it.
So special arrow.
Yeah, and before he fires it, he's talking to it like it's like a horse or a dog.
Uh-huh.
Something weird, which is I don't know. Again, like, you know, for all the discipline and, like, the modern discipline quality of the scene, then again, this whole scene's pretty short, as we said. You know, it comes down to one old heroic warrior kind of figure, which is what he quickly makes Bard into, from the seemingly, I don't know, washed-up old guy, run-of-the-mill guy, to, within 3 pages, he's a pretty epic warrior. He's doing like the old kind of stuff, like I'm using this family heirloom, talking to this arrow.
So you're making the case that we go from kind of a modern battle construction to a much more ancient heroic one in a short time, kind of right as the bird is landing on Bard's shoulder. Suddenly Bard becomes the backlit hero that we were saying we didn't see before.
Yeah, and we can talk about we'll talk about in a minute here about how else was he going to kill the dragon? But, you know, how could you do a more fitting way in this book, a great warrior killing the dragon?
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. I guess I don't know that I see it as it has to be that way. Like, I could see with the argument that you're setting up, if this is a more modern, grim, and non-heroic battle, that, you know, Smaug is beat by, I don't know, by determination or something like that. Like, he breaks the city down to the point of surrender, but it fails. He doesn't surrender, and he can't break it down any further, and they last, or something like that. Like, kind of an unsurprising, or like, yeah, I don't know.
Well, let's talk about how he actually died here. So, the thrush tells Bard the weak spot. Bard takes out the black arrow, and because, you know, we know the weak spot is, we mentioned last time, it's above the left breast. There's a hole, and he's basically got a bunch of gems that protect his soft belly.
Right.
And it's, you know, left breast, so that's right near the heart. So, you know, there's the darkness of Smaug's heart as...
yeah, he has no heart.
Out. Yeah, right. And
when you edit the episode, can you cue in, like, 80s... shot through the heart.
Yeah, I'll probably leave this part in too. Funnier. A couple other things though. It's you know, this is, it's kind of Smog's own fault, you know, just when it comes down to pride, because at any point, if he stopped attacking it, Smog would have continued to live. You know, it's the fact that he's going after the city that, you know, so he's basically bringing about his own death the longer he hangs around here.
And the, but, we heard that the final swoop was the lowest and closest to the town.
Yeah.
Which worked well for Bard, but yeah, that certainly points to the cockiness of Smog. Yeah.
Right, but then here is the key detail that I thought was interesting. As the moon rises, the moonlight gleams on Smog's gem-encrusted armor, except at the exposed spot. So that's how Bard finds it, and that's where he aims for it, mm-hmm. the darkness, and then he can shoot it. So, again, that might be like... It kind of fits in with like the luck conversation, because, again, maybe... You know, we've been saying luck's attached to Bilbo, mm-hmm. but maybe... Because the Thrush learned the secret from Bilbo that somehow extended to Bard.
Right.
That might be a stretch, but it also gets to involve our main character, which is not a bad thing in that situation.
Certainly, there's another way I could see that we look at it. Like, even though technically that knowledge about the weak spot is conveyed to Bard from the Thrush, from Bilbo, don't we have some kind of If anyone listened to our bonus episode about dragons, some kind of basic understanding or like cultural knowledge about like dragons probably have a weak spot.
Do we know that?
I'm not saying that Bard necessarily does in the story, or that we have any idea what they know about dragons, but there's kind of a general assumption about a weak spot with dragons, right?
I don't know if we talked about that in the episode, the dragon special.
Okay, well, even if we didn't talk about it...
Yeah, okay.
Is there anything that comes to mind? Because personally, I tend to assume, from various stories, that the dragons have a soft spot or a gap in their armor or whatever it is, and that's a recurring theme.
That might just be a recurring theme for all things ever, whether it's a good guy or a bad guy.
Achilles heel of sorts.
Yeah, Achilles was a good guy, but he's got the Achilles heel.
Any seemingly indomitable enemy has a way that they can be beat.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, if Superman didn't have the kryptonite... Actually, Superman got really boring anyways because he was pretty close to undefeatable.
Right.
You know, so it's like... So if you're going to have a good story, obviously there has to be a way that every single person can be conquered, whether it's good or bad.
Fair.
Yeah. It seemed... I don't know. I did think it was interesting. It's the... The moon rises up and it gleams on Smog's. You know, it's like the armor's all showing except the exposed spot's dark. So I mean to say,
I'm not trying to rewrite the story, but instead of being like, oh man, how lucky is that and how frustrating that the Thrush landed on Bard's shoulder at exactly the right time and it was just as he was stringing up the arrow. It was just as the dragon was swooping down and the moon was in the right place that everything went perfect and Bard hit the spot. And I'm saying, well, Thrush aside, Bard has got to be thinking, well, this dragon has to have a weak spot somewhere. And he happens to see a black hole in its heart as it's swooping down, glittering and glowing. You know, it's like there's some sort of it's not self-evident, but there's like it's like self-fulfilling a little bit to me.
Yeah, I agree with that, but you know, when you list out all those things like, oh, the Thrush just happened to talk to him, the moon just happened to be there, I mean, it's like no, we've been over this before. Like, yeah, all this stuff's luck, but that isn't chance that it just conveniently happens.
And that's what I mean to say, is that I think it's easy at first blush to look at it that way, but when you revisit it, it kind of makes sense that some of these things are happening together and that Bard would shoot where he did shoot. So that said, was Smog's death anticlimactic?
You know, I think I remember the first time I read this book, which is... years and years ago. I think I was kind of, the death was cool, but you know, this wasn't this is just some random character. I mean, I don't know. It was a cool scene, so I wasn't too upset.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, this was it.
Yeah, certainly, because every other chapter has involved Bilbo and the dwarves pretty heavily.
Right.
And
yeah, our main characters weren't even in the chapter.
Right. And Bilbo spoke to Smaug. We got the impression that they were going to see each other again. And the dwarves and Bilbo were kind of running scared through the caverns under the mountain. It all felt like it was leading up to some final confrontation, in my mind.
Right, alright, so I think it stunk that Thorin and the dwarves never actually saw Smaug themselves. I think that was, like, a missed opportunity.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then again, let's just go through some of the characters that are in this book here. Could Thorin have killed it? In my opinion, no, because these dwarves have proved themselves to just be extremely incompetent.
Right.
And that's partly, you know, to highlight Bilbo and how he's grown throughout the adventure. But, you know, Thorin, at this point in the story, no, Thorin's not brave enough or capable enough to kill him.
I'll be the devil's advocate there and say, had Thorin been the one to do it, that could have been his sort of redemption to an actually valuable part of the story. And it would make a little bit of sense, because we've talked before about Thorin being more of a traditional hero leader, kind of suited up in armor, strong, leading his people, and Bilbo being a bit of a modern hero, so...
Right, so I thought Thorin would have been a good candidate to actually do it, but where he's at in the story, I guess, yeah, maybe he can flip a switch, but, you know, we probably need, like, some sort of reason before he flips the switch, because they kind of proved themselves cowards.
Okay.
All the dwarves.
You know? Yeah.
The other choice, I think, would be Gandalf, obviously, even though he's not here, but, you know, somehow Gandalf could have come in, but I think that would be lame, actually, if it was just Gandalf that killed it, because he's, you know, for the part of the story that he was in, he was the facilitator of the adventure. He didn't actually want to make sure, you know, he wanted the job to get completed, but he didn't want to do it himself.
Right.
Maybe not out of, like, laziness or anything, but that's probably just not his job himself. He wants to inspire other people to do it who should rightfully do it.
Right.
You know?
And in a weird way, kind of the way that we've talked about chance and, like, providence in the story, I think a lot of the things surrounding Gandalf, because sometimes it seems like he's got this amazing power. Gandalf obviously makes decisions and has free will, but he kind of conforms to, like, the way things ought to happen, you know?
Yeah.
There's, like, this unspoken set of rules. Like, he's not going to get himself involved in certain plot lines that he's not involved in.
Right. And that's... There's a number of reasons for that. And one by one, I think we'll get to the discussion of that in Lord of the Rings. If we or Gandalf gets to Lord of the Rings. Who knows?
Yeah. Okay, so it can't be Thorin, it can't be Gandalf.
Well, then, you know, after that, I guess the next choice would be Bilbo, but from the beginning, you know, it's just, he's not, you know, they say he's the burglar, not the warrior. And, I mean, I thought that this read-through, but I think even the very first, you know, if I had to guess the very first time I read through it, I would just said, no, Bilbo can't really do it. You know, I mean, maybe he could, but I can't see him doing it, you know. And this was a big problem for Tolkien himself, because he actually wrote most of the book until about this chapter, and then somebody, like, actually kind of wanted to get the rights to, or, you know, actually wanted to publish it.
Right.
And so then he had to finish it up. So,
right.
I mean, Killing the Dragon was always a problem for him, because, you know, we had gone through the Norse examples. All right, there was Thor, he died. You know, he killed this beast, but he died himself. Uh-huh. Same with Beowulf, he died himself too. So it's like, well, those two are huge warriors, and, you know, if our main character died, that would kind of stink. Plus,
that there's kind of a history in the epic tale of the epic warrior going down in flames with his enemy.
Yeah, and they actually kind of did that with Bard here, because originally they all thought Bard was dead.
Right.
But then... Yeah, and then the only thing left was the Sigurd one, but as we talked about in the Dragon special, that was, you know, Turin's and Glaurung, the Turin and Glaurung story was mostly based off that.
Right.
So it's kind of like he already used it, even though he hadn't mm-hmm. released anything about it. Mm-hmm. So that one was kind of out. And I mean, you know, again, Bilbo is the modern character. How many modern people do you know? Like, do you personally know who you think would be like, yeah, he could be like a warrior kind of guy and kill a dragon? I could not think of anybody I know who would be like, you know, the proud, great, mighty warrior dragon slayer type person.
Well, I was thinking about this because you posed the question to me.
Yeah.
It's hard to think in, like, in terms of epic poetry compared to, like, it's like setting that up against people that we know.
Well, yeah, and it's because people aren't like that anymore. Like, in the medieval times, you know, there was knights and stuff who might have actually been like that.
Uh-huh.
Well, not to say any of them actually killed a dragon.
I would say, though, that, like, we don't necessarily see those qualities because we don't think of ourselves as, like, living in the same world. But a lot of traits, I believe, repeat themselves. And basically, in times of trauma, I think that kind of a random smattering of people that you know or we know, and a small proportion, notably, but some people would rise to the task of, like, taking over that heroic role, basically. Like, I'm thinking of a lot of these stories that we've sort of embraced. Like, I think we mentioned maybe in a book review or something on the show, you were talking about Unbroken and Louis Zamperini, who's a World War II vet who was at one point one of the fastest runners in the world and then was a POW for a long time. Kind of that whole book is like he starts out as kind of a random goofy teenager from California, suddenly becomes an amazingly driven runner, and then kind of rises to kind of ends up being a hero by the end of the story, pretty much because of these, like, ridiculous circumstances that he's thrown into. But I don't know that he would have displayed those traits while he's just, like, going to high school or something, you know?
Well, I agree, but I think that's closer to what Bilbo is as opposed to Bard, you know? Like, I don't imagine Louis Zamperini could stand, basically, stare down a dragon and then shoot him with an arrow.
Totally. I feel like the book totally sets that up. It's like the strength of his will and determination, at least by the end of it, is such that he's not backing down for anything. I get what you're saying.
No, but I think he's strong. I think he's super strong. Like, he would have been a super strong person, but I don't think he would have been the macho, huge ego, brave, strut into the cave, kill the dragon, or, like, you know, walk out on the boardwalk and shoot the dragon face to face.
With what you just said, there's a difference between strutting into the cave, I think, and being, like, maybe pompous in a Beowulf sort of way, like, I'm the strongest dude out there, I'm about to mess up this dragon, versus Bard, who is in, like, a moment of intense desperation, watching his town and everybody he knows be destroyed, basically. And he's in a last hope situation. Like, he has nothing else to look forward to in life. Like, he's preparing to die himself, basically. And I think, like, once people get to that point, obviously, like, the majority of people are going to kind of crumple and surrender. But some people, I believe, in surprising places are the ones who kind of, like, toe the line and are like, okay, screw it. I'm about to be destroyed by a dragon. Time to shoot this dragon with an arrow type thing.
Well, all right. Okay, so I can believe that. And I guess we could paint Bard as that kind of character. But mm-hmm. then again, when we read the rest of the chapter, he sounds like the old mythic hero warrior. And again, we don't know him that well. We maybe know him for, like, a couple pages. But there's, like, multiple times where he's referring to himself in the third person.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, this is... I mean, this is, like, cut out of just ancient times.
Yeah.
You know, certainly. Where it's the big strong guy that everybody looks forward to saving them, and then he does.
So,
but
something you just said made me think of this. You know your Greek literature better than I do. When Odysseus returns from his Odyssey, he returns in disguise, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And he's kind of making himself out to be like a lesser man than he is until the heroic moment with the bow.
Right, yeah, he disguises himself so that he gets the lay of the land of everything, and that takes, like, forever. Yeah. But yeah, then he's just like, all right, let's go to town. All these people have been living off my land.
Uh-huh.
They gotta die.
So I just thought of that. It feels like a specific reference that Tolkien's pulling from, not so much with the time to take back what's mine type thing, but like a hero in disguise as basically like a insignificant night watchman. And then in this moment of trial and tribulation, he's got like the heroic slinging of the bow, and that's what defines him. That kind of, he like emerges from this disguise as a different man.
Yeah, but you know, now that we're talking, I like what you're saying about, you know, he's just the regular hero who steps up, kind of. Mm-hmm. But I think Tolkien might have just had in mind the Odysseus thing, like what you just mentioned. Mm-hmm. There, but maybe it was a combination of both. I think that's the coolest way to think about it, would be a combination of both.
Okay. So you mentioned a step on the hero's journey. I can be your hero, baby. There goes my hero. Watch him as he goes. I'm a hero. Be larger than life. Larger than life.
Yeah, so the hero step that we're on now is the ultimate boon. I feel like we're around like step 14, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're at 14. Yeah.
Maybe. Perfect. Well, chapter 14, we're at, step 14.
Yeah, chapter 14. Yeah. Well, there's only 17 steps, but yeah. All right. So, anyways, this one, all you really need to know is this is when the quest is achieved. So, like, boon is like the ultimate treasure. So it's like we got it. Like everything we were going after, we were hoping for the whole book. It's come true. We did it.
Right.
So, you know, this would be like the climax of every movie ever, you know. so any movie where the bad guy's been terrorizing the whole time and he's defeated, so every single superhero movie ever. Mm-hmm. This is it. Or, you know, anytime somebody wins the big race or they win the big championship or the big game in a sports movie, this is it. Or, you know, nowadays it's even like if they can just come close to, you know, They complete it or give everything they got or go the distance, like in Rocky.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. In, I don't know, I guess dance movies or music movies, you know, there's like a big competition and then they nail it at mm-hmm. the end. So the first that would be like Whiplash, you know. That movie's really cool. Because that's exactly where it ended, was as soon as that mm-hmm. was done. There was no like fallout afterwards, which mm-hmm. was sweet. War movies might be slightly more complicated, but it's most likely after the big, huge battle that was completed, or like maybe once the soldier gets home, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was just thinking, like in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, it would be when he gets like Willy Wonka's factory because he passes it on to him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Right. That was what happened in that movie.
Yes.
Yeah. But now, in the Matrix, that would be like when Neo, you know, he comes back mm-hmm. alive, you know, because he was shot a bunch of times at the end of mm-hmm. the first one. But it's not quite that part. It's probably when he actually kills mm-hmm. Agent Smith, you know, the main agent. Like, he just goes inside of him, and then he blows him up, and then he's, like, all alive, and, like, yeah. So, and obviously, you know, this is what you're waiting for in the whole movie and everything, so it's very satisfying, usually,
right.
You know?
Right.
Do you have any examples before we get to our classic Star Wars example?
I mean, I could make up a few real quick, but I think this is probably the easiest for everybody to think of any story that they know, because it is the climax.
All right, Clifford, so you don't have any.
Yeah, I'm just talking my way out of it, as usual.
Fine. All right, so in Star Wars, you know, you could probably, I don't know, it seems like you can apply the whole hero's journey thing to just the episode 4, so the original 1 movie. So that would be mm-hmm. when he blew up the Death Star, I guess, Luke, you know.
But,
or you could apply it to the whole trilogy, which is, I think, kind of what I've been doing. So this
when
would
he
be,
blows up the Death Star again.
Well, Luke doesn't blow up the Death Star. Luke and his
true.
Luke gets his dad back, so Vader slash Anakin, and then
right.
he gets him to kill the Emperor, so the Emperor's destroyed, and then his friends are blowing up the Death Star. And Luke escapes off the Death Star, obviously.
Of course.
Yeah. So, you know, here in this story, Is it, you know, going into the book, when you hear about this step, it's like, okay, when Smaug gets killed, that's the ultimate boon. Because, I mean, that's what we've been waiting for this whole book, the whole audience, right?
Right.
You know? But as we were saying, I mean, you know, I liked the scene, I liked the chapter, but it was kind of anticlimactic because our main characters, like any sort of main character, was very far away from all of this action. So in my opinion, how can this be a hero step if our hero isn't even here?
Yeah, hard to say. That's probably my biggest doubt about you claiming this is in fact the ultimate boon.
Well, so that's why I'd say the ultimate boon probably actually happened all the way back in the last chapter when Bilbo found the Arkenstone. So it happened quick and it happened quietly. But I mean, that was the greatest treasure of the mountain. So maybe the real ultimate boon was claiming back the treasure, you know?
Well, okay, so let me run with that for a second.
Okay.
You're saying the ultimate boon is the climax of the story. It's what we've all been waiting for.
No, it's when the quest is achieved.
The quest is achieved, I'm sorry.
Yeah, let's go with that.
When they started out, when the dwarves showed up at Bilbo's house, their stated goal was to reclaim their home, the mountain.
No, and part of that... it was get the treasure back, I think.
Get the treasure back. But, I mean, yeah. Reclaim their treasure and their home. And they noted the biggest obstacle in the way is the dragon Smaug. But yeah. They clearly point out that he is in the way of their goal. Killing Smaug himself is not the goal of their journey.
Right, so that's another point why I think it fits in that the Arkenstone might actually be the ultimate boon.
Okay.
You know, like, because you could think, it's when the quest is achieved, but lots of times in mythology, maybe it's like when a big evil's defeated or something.
Right.
But lots of times it is just more, you know, you win a treasure, you get a jewel.
Right.
Or something like that. And so, yeah, they actually got to the treasure, and they were kind of partying it up, and then like the symbol of the whole of the treasure as a whole would probably be the Arkenstone. I think that's fair to say, based off the little bit that we know. Like, it's the heart of the mountain is what they're saying. So Bilbo has that, our main character. He didn't tell anybody else, which is just kind of interesting. But yeah, I'd say that was the real ultimate boon.
How about this?
Which is still it's still kind of anticlimactic for the audience.
Well, how about this? This is, as far as I know, the only point in the story where Tolkien rewinds and tells a simultaneous story. Like, this chapter and the last chapter technically happen at the same time as each other, right?
Well, this probably even happens before the last chapter, yeah.
True.
Because it's mostly... True. This probably would have happened while they were just literally sitting in the tunnel for, like, a day.
Yeah, I guess so. I was going to put forward the theory that maybe Smaug is killed at the same instant that Bilbo grabs the Arkenstone.
See, I thought my theory would be Smaug was killed at the moment that Bilbo felt like lighthearted, to where he's like, you know what, I'm going to go explore. That would be my guess.
That's a good point. That's a good point. I forgot about that detail. That makes a lot of sense.
But I think even that timing is too late.
Okay.
I don't know. But we could still, I don't know. That's my guess.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyways, though, but like even Star Wars, though, you know, Luke and Anakin, his dad, killed the Emperor.
Uh-huh.
It's mostly actually just the dad,
right?
Darth Vader.
Right.
But yeah, that's the main leader dead. So that's like, but that's only like one half of the equation. You still got to defeat the whole Empire, and it was his friends that blew up the Death Star. So I mean, you know, again, that's kind of the same thing here. It's like, all right, they actually get the treasure, which is what they want, and then some like loose friend or acquaintance actually finishes off the dragon too. So
right.
Maybe they work together in tandem.
Right.
Then the other thing I'd say about this step is, in lots of these, in many movies, this is about the end of the movie. Maybe there's like a couple wrap-up scenes after that, but where they might hit one more future step on the hero's journey, but this is about it.
Right.
You know? And again, that's satisfying because it's like, well, that's all we really want, and then, yeah, we're done. But I'd say probably the best example of the ultimate boon in accordance with all the steps of the hero's journey would be Indiana Jones. Because I forget the... I don't know Temple of Doom that well. But, like, Raiders of the Lost Ark, especially that one. And then also even the Last Crusade, when he gets the Holy Grail and when he gets the Ark of the Covenant. Mm-hmm. You know, he gets those, which is like, yeah, that's what we've been after the whole time. But then he's got to, like, fight for it. Because, you know, there's other enemies around. And so, like, there's still action that goes on after that. So it's like, the story's not over at all. Just like with The Hobbit here. You know, we still got, like, I don't know, five chapters to go.
Right.
Yeah. So, and we still got a couple more steps on the hero's journey, too, to hit. So, I mean, this isn't over at all.
Okay. I'll take it.
Which kind of leads us into our next thing here, because, you know, Smaug dies, and then they start Tolkien starts talking about the town right away, like, you know, it, I don't know, the chapter just continues without a hitch, really.
Yeah, so, yeah, which struck me as another thing that, yeah, made it a little anticlimactic. They jump right into the rebuilding of the town, the struggle of getting through the winter, Bard takes the lead, but doesn't necessarily wrest control from the master of the town. But probably the most important detail, we hear that the birds of the sky of the area are all a Twitter and are basically spreading the word as soon as it happens that Smaug has died. So everyone finds out about it, including the Elven King in the forest, who we left behind a few chapters ago.
And that makes sense. He's very close.
Right. And he's got his ear to the ground on just about everything.
Yeah.
But even Bjorn hears it, and even the goblins in the Misty Mountains hear it, all the way on the other side of the forest.
Right. I thought that was interesting. I don't really get it. Besides that, he's just drawing in stuff that's been around, you know, that we're acquainted with. But it's like, oh, okay. You guys found out already. Interesting.
Yeah. Everybody knows. Well, it implied to me that it's like, I don't know what the perfect movie reference would be. But this is when the moment where, like, everybody kind of turns and stops and is like, oh geez, like last one there's a rotten egg type thing, like we gotta go after this treasure.
And, well, yeah, I mean that was kind of interesting. So like Bard, well, first of all, the cowardly master was saying, you know, they were getting pissed at all the townspeople were getting pissed at him because he was so useless as their leader, and so then he pushes off. He's like, hey, come on, the dwarves. You know, they're the ones we should really be pissed at. And then Bard's just like, oh, don't even think about the dwarves. They probably died. And then it's like, psh, like mirror shatter. Like, wait, that treasure's completely unguarded. And then meanwhile, like you said, the Elf King has his ear to the ground. And he's just like, sweet, Smaug's dead? Let's go. That treasure's unguarded. You know, we talked about how savvy the Elf King is. You know, he's just all about it. But then I thought it was interesting that he had a heart that, you know, he made his troops turn around and go help the lake men first before they went to the mountain. So it's like, all right, respect elves. That's good. That's a good move.
Most definitely.
Because, I mean, you know, it was within their power to just walk up, take it all.
Right. Exactly.
But instead, we end with the men and elves marching together to go take it. Where do you think it goes from here?
Well, I mean, like I was saying, it certainly feels like it's setting up for, if not a battle, then some sort of race where everyone's running for this treasure. But even that can't be totally harmless because the dwarves are already there, but they don't know, etc. So we're gonna have some chaos on our hands, I'd say.
Yeah, I thought it's you know, again, to put this in perspective, that this is a kid's book, just like that it's not over once the dragon dies is kind of interesting. Like, I mean, you know, kid's book, usually simple story. Not to say that there's anything wrong with that at all. I usually like a simple story myself, but now we're in uncharted territory that if you're a first-time reader, I don't think you really expect this.
Agreed.
Yeah. Last note of things that I wanted to talk about, though. It was interesting that Lake Town was so destroyed that, or Azeroth is its other name, which is also noteworthy that this is like the first thing that's not, Azeroth is like the first name we come across that's not just like a land feature kind of name.
And correct me if I'm wrong, he didn't call it Azeroth in the when it was first introduced, right?
No. In the Lake Town chapter, no, he didn't. Like, he introduced the name Azeroth in this chapter. Maybe that's because he was focusing on
it. That's a little bit weird to me.
Or maybe, you know, maybe all these land feature names that we've had, like Dale and Rivendell and the Misty Mountains and Mirkwood, which is a dark forest, you know. Maybe they all have like kind of proper names that he just hasn't been using, like Azeroth.
Interesting. Yeah.
Kind of interesting to think about. That's a conversation we will return to in Lord of the Rings. I promise you. Like, very early in Lord of the Rings.
I'll stay posted.
Yeah. But anyways, Lake Town was so destroyed, but they decided, all right, we're going to build a little bit further north so that we're away from the corpse, because Smaug's corpse was sitting in there, and then it had those gems all in the belly to protect it. But nobody even went to die for the gems years later because, I don't know, it was just such a kind of cursed burial site almost.
Right.
Also, to go back to your our swamp conversation, you know, it's whatever they were on, I don't know, if it didn't really imply that they were on dry land, but it implied that they had fields around, so why wouldn't they just have built the town on fields besides trading purposes in the middle of the water?
True, true.
I know this this conversation's from like four chapters ago.
No, that makes a lot of that is a little bit weird, like, knowing that the dragon is gone, I don't know. It could be, yeah, that all the shores are not clear enough to have a proper harbor, and they definitely depend on the trade.
So it's February 4th. I think we're hitting our stride, Clifford.
Yeah, we're doing well.
Ah, shoot, dude, we got a review this week. We got to read it.
Okay.
All right, so this review is from Is Fizz Liz.
Is this Liz?
Yeah, but there's no S's. It's just a bunch of Z's.
Oh.
Maybe that's hip or cool. I don't know. All right, anyways. This will make you smarter. 5 stars. See, the key to that was Liz said 5 stars. If you've ever wondered, when exactly is Durin's Day? This podcast is for you. Patrick and Clifford provide a masterful deep dive, including interesting insights on historical and cultural influences on Tolkien's work. There we go. 5 stars, beer koozie right there.
Sweet.
That's how you do it. That's it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm kind of wondering why we don't have 105 of these by now. But, you know.
Do you have 105 beer koozies?
Oh, yeah. That's the other thing. Limited edition. There's only going to be 100 in existence.
What?
Yeah, that's
maybe
correct.
I need to make a review.
You already did, remember? We did that.
You told me to delete it. You told me to make it fake.
Oh, well, yeah, you can make a fake. Yeah, you can make a review where I don't know it's you. Well, I mean, yeah, you should get on that. This is Liz. Send an email to talkingtokenpodcast@gmail.com. Send us an email and with an address, and you'll get your
review. To make it a little bit easier. try to contact us.
Anything else? What else was going on? What's up for you this weekend? Marathon training coming up for Austin.
Marathon training.
Yeah.
This weekend was the Super Bowl. I think everyone agrees it was a pretty big disappointment.
This weekend was the Cyclocross World Championships.
I was trying to let you know that the Super Bowl was not worth watching. So anyways, what did I miss while watching this?
The true champion won. Matthew Vanderpool, he had been the most dominant guy for the past 2 years. He choked like never before last year. I had never seen a greater choke than the 2018 World Championship from Matthew Vanderpool. Like, I just couldn't believe it. I was so pissed at him. But this year, you know, Wout put up a good fight. Wout was in shape. But, you know, I just don't think cyclocross is Wout Van Aert's priority at this point. He was up for it, but, you know, Vanderpool was the best on the day. There's this really technical section where, you know, he had to be able to ride it without dismounting, and Vanderpool could do that 9 times out of 10. Actually, literally 10 times out of 12 for this race, because there was 12 laps of it. and Wout had to get off close every time. It was a good win. He deserved it. Wout put up a decent fight. Too bad it didn't last the whole race, but, yeah. It was fun times in Denmark. Cyclocross. Good, wow. Good sport. Check it out if you haven't.
You missed my joke. I said wow after your description.
Well, wow, we could do a little philology there. Wout's the American version of Walt. So Wouter is a very common name in Belgium and the Netherlands.
Wow. Wouter?
Yeah, and that's our version of Walter. Okay. Same with Matthew. It's really Matthew Vanderpool. You know, Matthew would be his real name. Yeah, but it's Matthew. Like the way they sound it sounds like they're sneezing every time.
Matthew.
Yeah. Alright. I think we'll leave it there.
Indeed. Thanks, y'all.